Good morning. This is Howell Jackson, and I'd like to welcome you to the first substantive lecture of my series for the Law Department of Peking University. This morning's lecture is on an introduction to financial institutions. The primary purpose of today's exercise is to discuss the unidentified financial institution exercise from my casebook. For those of you who have not yet had a chance to look at the exercise, it appears in Chapter 1. I would suggest that you try to answer the questions posed by the exercise before you begin listening to this lecture. You can, of course, pause the lecture at any time and refer to the casebook if you would find that helpful. But before I begin discussion of the unidentified financial institutions exercise, there are a few introductory words I would like to say about intermediation and the conventions I will be using in the slides throughout this lecture series. There are also a few administrative items that I need to deal with before the substance of the lecture begins. Let me start with the administrative items. As most of you probably already know, the discussion groups are now operating. A number of you have already posted comments to the initial discussion group, and those who have not yet done so should make sure they posted at least one comment to make sure they're familiar with the technology. Another matter that I would like to mention is the casebook and statutory supplement. I understand that these books have arrived in Peking, but are being held at the customs office. They may have already been released, but perhaps they haven't. I'm sure that Mr. Tong from Dean Wu's office will inform you when the casebooks are available. In the meantime, I will post excerpts from the casebook on the web page so that you can follow the assignments I give for the lecture series. For example, this week there is posted an excerpt which includes the unidentified financial institution we will be discussing. If you don't have the casebook, make sure you download that excerpt so you can follow the lecture. Finally, I should also mention the lecture notes, which are posted on the web page. These lecture notes are being prepared by one of my teaching fellows for this course, Ren Yun Nan, who many of you know as a former graduate of the Peking Law Department. I'm extremely grateful to Mr. Ren for assisting me in preparing these lecture notes. Now, I will turn to the substance of today's lecture, which begins with an introduction to intermediation. Let's begin today's discussion with the question of what is intermediation? To address this issue, imagine, if you will, a person with, say, $25 who wants to get into the business of financial intermediation. This could be a person, as illustrated here, or a corporate entity. In any event, imagine that this entity or individual wanted to start the intermediation business. To do that would take two things. First, the individual would need to acquire funds from other parties. In this hypothetical, imagine that he arranged to borrow $75 at an interest rate of 4%. Then imagine further that this individual were to lend the funds. Both the borrowed funds of $75 and the $25 already in his own account. That would lead to a total of $100, which could be lent out at some other interest rate. In this example, I have assumed the interest rate to be 5%. The individual is now engaged in the business of intermediation, borrowing funds from some parties, lending funds to other parties. In this lecture series, I will use a certain graphical convention to convey intermediation. For the individual just being discussed, you could imagine the balance sheet of that person or entity looking similar to the balance sheet on the screen. on the right-hand side, the liabilities, there would be $75 of borrowing, and capital, that is funds belonging to the individual himself or the corporation itself, of $25, for a total capital and liabilities of $100. That will be matched on the left-hand side, the asset side, of $100. This is a simple stylized balance sheet. As we continue in today's discussion, you will see more complex forms that represent more realistic institutions. Now, having described the balance sheet of this hypothetical intermediary, it is also worth considering what the intermediary's income statement would look like, what its profits and losses might be. This is relatively easy to do in the example I have started with. On the loan, which is the entity's sole source of income, there is interest equal to $5, 5% of $100. There is also cost of borrowing, or cost of funds borrowed, equal to $3, which is 4% of the $75 the individual or entity borrowed, leaving a net profit of $2. So, on $100 of assets, the institution made $2 in this time period, presumably 1 year. Now, a common question to ask, an important question to ask to compare financial intermediaries, is how well or how profitable was the firm with these operations and this balance sheet. There are various ways to make that measurement, but two that I want to highlight right now are steps of return on assets and return on equity. Return on assets is a measure of an institution's profit spread over its entire asset base. In the case of this institution, there was $2 of profit on $100 of assets, a 2% return, which is often described as 200 basis points as a return on assets. The return on equity is a slightly different measure. It compares the profitability of the institution to the capital invested in the institution, typically by its owners. In this case, the owner had $25 of equity invested in the firm. $2 of profit is 8% return on equity, because $2 is 8% of $25. This basic illustration shows one of the advantages of financial intermediation, which is the leverage it provides to equity participants. Although the overall return on assets for the institution was only 200 basis points, or 2%, the return on equity was 4 times that much, or 8%. By increasing leverage, as we will see, financial intermediaries can increase the return on equity for their equity investors. This is a point to which we will return later in the lecture series. Going back to the stylized balance sheet, let me just make a few more comments about the presentations I will use later in this lecture. One could summarize the information that I have already discussed in a single slide, showing the basic balance sheet, which I've already discussed, and the different rates of return. Typically, an intermediary, if it's going to be successful, will borrow money at a lower rate of interest than it will lend money. Essentially, the way the intermediaries make money is on the spread, that is, the difference between the rate of return earned on assets and the cost of funds. I will also discuss later in this lecture. Over the course of the semester, you will become quite familiar with diagrams of this sort. All of the financial intermediaries that are the subject of our discussion have the same basic structure of balance sheet. They gain their resources primarily from financial liabilities. in the hypothetical I was just discussing, the liability was just a general form of borrowing. The particular kinds of liabilities that we'll be looking at this in this lecture series are, of course, deposits in banks and other depository institutions, insurance policies of various sorts, investments in mutual funds and other pooled investment vehicles, and various other kinds of individual investment. All of the intermediaries also reinvest their resources, typically in financial assets, with only a small percentage of their investments being in physical property or other kinds of resources. Another characteristic feature of financial intermediaries that we will discuss in some detail later in the course is relatively low levels of capital as compared with other kinds of liabilities. In other words, all of the intermediaries we will be studying this semester are relatively highly leveraged. And of course, the regulation of this leverage, or capital requirements, is an important component of financial institutions' regulation. Let's turn now to some more realistic examples, and in particular, the unidentified financial institutions exercise from Chapter 1 of our casebook. If you have the casebook, this exercise can be found on pages 14 to 26. If you have not yet received the casebook, you should be able to download these pages from the RFI webpage. The download will be in Acrobat format, but that should be adequate to print out for use for purposes of following today's lecture. Before I begin my discussion of the exercise itself, let me just say a few introductory words about this exercise and why I think it's an interesting and appropriate vehicle to begin the study of a law course on the regulation of financial institutions. Initially, this exercise was used to teach business school students studying finance. I think it is relevant to legal studies, however, because it is also important for us to understand the business of financial intermediaries, what they are trying to do, and what incentives they operate under in the real world. One of the reasons we have regulation in this area is to deal with problems that are thought to be associated with business practices in this field. To understand how the regulations are designed and what they're supposed to do, it's necessary to understand what the intermediaries themselves are up to. Also, looking a bit to the future, if you want to understand how to design appropriate regulatory structures, it's important to understand the incentives that financial intermediaries will be under to either not comply with the regulations or seek to avoid them. This is an important part, I think, of regulatory design. Let's turn now to the first financial institution in the exercise, which is unidentified institution number A. Now, the task here, one of the tasks of this exercise, is to identify which intermediaries are represented by which balance sheets. And that's something I do want to discuss in today's lecture. But for purposes of this lecture series, what I think is particularly important is using the balance sheets to learn more about the businesses these intermediaries conduct in the United States. At the end of the lecture, one of the questions I will ask the students is the extent to which the intermediaries you see in these exercises are similar to or different from the ones you have in China. I would be very interested to hear the relationship between our intermediaries and the intermediaries that you are learning about in your ordinary courses. Okay, now let's begin to take a look at Institution A. If you look at its balance sheet, beginning on page 16, you'll see that the institution has a little more than $1 billion, 1,000 million U.S. dollars of assets. In the United States, actually, this would be a very small financial intermediary, although $1 billion is a substantial amount of money. Looking to the liability side of the institution's balance sheet, the striking characteristic is the relatively simple funding structure the institution enjoys. Close to 90% of its funds come from deposits. The balance sheet doesn't give too much detail here, but these are essentially savings deposits from individuals. And this institution is what's known as a savings bank in the United States. This is a kind of financial intermediary that is particularly common in the northeastern part of the United States and has its origins in the 19th century when these institutions developed to encourage savings on the part of the workforce. In fact, this institution is the Cambridge Savings Bank in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's actually in Harvard Square, right across from the university. And those of you who have traveled to Harvard have probably walked in front of its doors. As I mentioned before, it is a relatively small institution specializing in the collection of savings deposits. The deposits are, in turn, invested into two basic categories of assets. Roughly 27% of the assets are invested in short-term instruments, investment securities, and cash, all relatively liquid forms of investment. The other substantial investment, in fact, the dominant investment of this intermediary, are loans. Some 68% of its assets are invested in loans, and if you consult the balance sheet more carefully, you'll see that the majority of the loans, in fact, the majority of all the institution's assets, are invested in mortgages and commercial real estate loans. So essentially, this intermediary is a specialized mortgage lending intermediary that raises its funds with savings deposits and reinvests them in loans. Another few preliminary points to make about this balance sheet. As I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of the assets of this intermediary and all the other intermediaries that we will look at in this course are invested in financial assets. A very small amount, less than 5%, are in other assets, including building equipment and other peripheral items. Another point to make about this institution is that it has a relatively small capital base, referred to in this illustration as retained earnings. This capital is the accumulated earnings of the institution over a number of years. It is less than 10% of the institution's assets, but constitutes a typical capital base for an institution of this sort. So this first illustration is what I would characterize as a relatively simple depository institution in the United States. If one turns to the income statement, one can begin to discuss a bit more about the institution's profitability. You can derive from the income statement, and I'll leave it to the students to try to do that for themselves, the rate of return that this financial intermediary is earning on its two classes of assets. The liquid assets on average earned 6.3% in 1997, the period of this financial statement. The lending portfolio earned a higher yield of 7.3%. Both kinds of assets, however, earned more than the institution had to pay out on its deposits. The cost of its deposits was roughly 4.1%. So, as in the introductory hypothetical, this institution is performing the basic function of intermediation. It is borrowing money at one rate from a group of individual investors and then relending or investing the funds into the market or loans at a higher rate of return. So it has a positive spread. At this point, it's relevant to ask the question of how well is the Cambridge Savings Bank doing in 1997. That is also something that can be derived from the income statement and balance sheet that you have before you. as we've already discussed, the rate of return on the institution's investments was greater than its cost of funds. So the institution had what is sometimes referred to as positive net interest income. In fact, if you look down at its balance sheet, you'll see an item marked net income after provision for possible losses, which is essentially the net interest income, of $33.3 million. If one were to spread that over the institution's entire asset base, roughly $1.1 billion, it has a spread of about 303 basis points. So roughly 3% gross return on assets. That is not, however, this institution's return on assets, because the institution is more complicated than the introductory hypothetical I began with. There are other items of income and expense. The institution made, for example, $2.3 million additional dollars in other income, presumably fees for other services and functions provided to customers, which increased its profitability. On the other hand, the institution also had a substantial amount of other expenses, that is, expenses other than the cost of money borrowed. In this case, it was $24.8 million, which equaled 226 basis points. There were also taxes the institution had to pay to the government of $4.1 million, or 37 basis points. After making all of these adjustments, adding the additional income and then subtracting the other expenses and taxes, the total return on assets for the institution was $6.7 million. That was its net income, or 61 basis points. So even though this institution had a 300 basis point spread on its interest income and expenses, after making other appropriate adjustments, in particular, after paying all of the expenses associated with maintaining the bank, paying the employees, buying equipment, and other supplies necessary to stay in business, its return was reduced to 61 basis points, less than 1% of assets. If one measures this in terms of return on equity, the $6.7 million was equal to roughly 8.4% return on equity, a relatively modest rate of return, but not disastrously so for the United States in this period. So if one looks at this balance sheet, one can see the basic operations of a simple financial intermediary in the United States in 1997. Now, I'd like to turn to some of the questions I posed about this balance sheet in the unidentified financial institution's problem. I want to turn to the question of how might this institution improve its profitability? This is not a simple, idle query. It is an important investigation for purposes of the study of the regulation of financial institutions, because, at least in the United States, we operate under the assumption that institutions will generally try to increase their profitability in order to satisfy shareholders and increase other kinds of returns to employees, or to reduce the cost of borrowing, or to otherwise compete in the marketplace. So we operate under the assumption that institutions are constantly trying to enhance their profitability. And the question I'd like to consider for a moment now is, how would an institution, such as the unidentified financial institution A, go about achieving that result? You should think about that question yourself for a moment. But let me just raise a few possibilities looking at the balance sheet that we've already discussed. One possibility would be to rearrange its assets, to move assets from the relatively less profitable cash and short-term investments into the more profitable loans. One could even imagine finding new classes of assets that generated higher rates of return to increase the gross yield on the company's portfolio. Similarly, you might imagine the institution seeking out sources of less expensive funding. If they could find some sort of deposit base that they would have to pay less than 4.1% rate of return on each year, that would also increase the institution's spread. So, two basic strategies would be trying to lower their cost of funds or increasing their return on investment. These two possibilities do not, however, exhaust the list of possibilities. If one thinks back to the overall balance sheet, the institution derived some benefit from other income, that is, income other than interest. One could imagine the institution pursuing a strategy of increasing this non-interest source of income by expanding into new lines of business and providing greater services to customers and other individuals. In fact, in the United States, the trend towards non-interest income has been an extremely important one in the last 10 or 15 years. Another possibility would be to reduce the non-interest expenses that the institution incurs. If you remember the balance sheet, salary and office expenses and other expenses were a substantial drain on the company's overall earnings. Another possibility would be to reduce the size of the staff, to reduce the size of the offices, to replace, for example, tellers with automatic teller machines, a variety of strategies to reduce overall costs and hence increase profitability. Yet another possibility for increasing return on earnings would be to increase the size of the institution itself, provided the capital base were not also increased. This would, of course, increase the leverage of the institution, but by increasing the leverage, the institution could also increase its return on equity. As we go through the semester, you will see examples of institutions doing all of these strategies, and we will from time to time consider the regulatory implications of the profit incentive that financial intermediaries operate under in the United States. Let's turn now to Institution B. First, a basic comparison between Institution A and Institution B. What's the same and what's different? Well, one thing that's similar is the balance sheet on the asset side, the left-hand side. Like unidentified Institution A, this intermediary has a relatively small amount of its assets invested in cash and investment securities. Actually, a much smaller amount than Intermediary A, less than 10% here. The bulk of assets are again invested in what's denominated on this slide as net receivables, but if you looked at the balance sheet more carefully, you'd see that there were home equity receivables, that's a form of mortgage, loan, Visa and MasterCard receivables, which are credit card receivables from lending to consumers, and various other kinds of receivables, and private label, presumably credit cards. So this intermediary is an intermediary making individual loans, some of which are secured by home equity, a lot of it unsecured credit card debt. To some extent, this is an intermediary that has pursued the strategies I was just mentioning above. It's reduced the amount of its assets in relatively low-yielding investment securities and increased its investment in net receivables that are higher yielding. Looking over to the liability side of the balance sheet, the institution looks quite different than Institution A. Rather than getting all of its deposits, all of its funds from deposits, this intermediary relies on a number of different funding sources, none of which, in substantial degree, represents deposits. Most of its funds come from senior and subordinated debt. That is, a form of debt raised in the capital markets. These are securities issued to public investors, either institutional investors or individuals. A small amount of funding comes from insurance policies and reserves, which means that this intermediary has a subsidiary of some sort engaged in the insurance business, and then a fair amount of funding, over 21%, comes from commercial paper, that is, short-term paper, and bank borrowings. So, in fact, some of this intermediary's fundings come from other institutions. This institution actually is not one that we will be studying directly in this course because it is not, strictly speaking, a regulated financial intermediary. It's what's known in the United States as a finance company or a finance corporation. And in fact, this institution is Household Finance Corporation, which is one of the largest finance corporations in the United States. If you'll note its size, $22.9 billion of total assets, you can see that it's more than 20 times bigger than Institution A. And in fact, it operates in a national market, whereas Institution A only serves local borrowers and lenders in the Massachusetts market. So this is an unregulated intermediary. It's unregulated because it doesn't raise its funds through deposits or primarily insurance or another form of activity that would subject the whole corporation to comprehensive regulatory structure. Various aspects of this business, of course, will be subject to regulations of various sorts, but it is not regulated in the same way that a savings bank or an insurance company or a mutual fund in the United States would be regulated. That's an interesting fact to bear in mind, however, because this intermediary does compete in certain respects with the intermediaries that we will be dealing with. For example, in home equity lending and in consumer loans, it would be competing to some extent with the Cambridge Savings Bank we've already discussed. So one of the facts of the American financial landscape is there's a fair amount of competition in certain areas, particularly in the lending markets, between regulated and non-regulated intermediaries. Dig into the balance sheet of this institution just a little bit further. Note the cost of funds that this intermediary raises. There is a funding cost on average of roughly 5.5% for this intermediary's liabilities, which is, as you may recall, higher than the cost of funds for the institution A we've already discussed. That institution's cost of funds was roughly 4.1%. So deposits are a relatively low-cost source of funds for intermediaries, and household finance would, in theory, like to supplement its funding structure with deposits if it could achieve them at the same rates that the Cambridge Savings Bank achieves them. And in fact, at various times, household finance has attempted to become a depository institution or to own subsidiaries that are depository institutions to take advantage of these lower costs of funds. On the asset side of the balance sheet, the interesting thing about this intermediary is the relatively higher rate of return that it earns on its assets. Again, if you compare it to Institution A, its average rate of return for its loans was on the order of 7%. Here, the household finance net receivables earn about 12.1%. That's because, on average in the United States, consumer receivables pay a higher rate of return. So in essence, this intermediary has increased its profitability by seeking out higher return investments. You'll notice, however, that its equity cushion of 17.6% is higher than what we observed with intermediary A. So for a variety of reasons, this institution has chosen to have more reserves than the other intermediary we just looked at. In terms of overall profitability, household finance presents an interesting picture. As I just discussed, its net interest margin is relatively good, at least compared with Institution A. Its total spread is 504 basis points, so 5% on assets. Its return on assets is substantially higher than its cost of funds. What's really striking about this intermediary, however, is its other sources of income. They generate even more income than the rate of return on its lending portfolio. And if one looks more carefully into the balance sheet, which you can't do easily on the information that has been provided in the casebook, you would see that these additional sources of income come from the securitization of assets and other fee income that the corporation generates. Another noteworthy feature of this intermediary is the relatively high cost of its other expenses, 506 basis points. Compared to institution A, this is relatively expensive, presumably because of the personnel costs and other costs associated with maintaining the consumer lending business in the United States. On balance, in terms of profitability, one would have to say that household finance is substantially more profitable than institution A. The total return on assets of this institution is 224 basis points, and even with its relatively low rate of leverage, its return on equity is 17.6%, substantially higher than what we saw in Institution A. Turning to Institution C, we see another depository institution, but a more complicated one. This institution is the Harris Bank of Chicago, Illinois, a relatively substantial depository institution located in the Midwestern section of the United States. This intermediary's balance sheet is relatively similar to the balance sheet of Cambridge Savings Bank, Institution A, but it is again much larger, again with more than $20 billion of assets. Even though the institution is roughly 20 times larger than the Cambridge Savings Bank, the basic structure of its balance sheet is quite similar. Equity is less than 10% of assets. Most of the funding comes from deposits, although here we see the deposit sources are more varied, including both domestic deposits and deposits in foreign branches. There is slightly greater complexity in the balance sheet, as 20% of the assets are funded through other sorts of liabilities. On the asset side of the balance sheet, again, we see basic similarities to the Cambridge Savings Bank, although, again, more complexity with a slightly greater diversity in its investment structures. Still, however, net loans at more than 54% of the portfolio constitute the largest sort of investment. If one looks over to the income statement and tries to reverse engineer the cost of funds and the return on assets, one sees relatively similar to what we saw with the Cambridge Savings Bank. Cost of funds here are on average 3.3% for deposits, which is in fact a little lower than what Cambridge Savings Bank had, probably because this institution has a fair amount of corporate demand deposits, which typically do not pay interest in the United States. There are also similarities in the funding structure with low rate of return investments in cash and money market assets, relatively higher rates of return on portfolio securities, trading securities, and the highest rates of return on the institution's net loan portfolio. Profitability. Harris Bank does somewhat better, although not substantially better, than Cambridge Savings Bank. Its total return on assets is 78 basis points, which is fine, but also below average for 1997 in the United States, as was in all likelihood its return on equity of 9.6%. The interesting thing about the income statement for our purposes is the source of profitability of this institution. In this respect, it is quite different than the Cambridge Savings Bank. It had a substantial net interest income or interest margin of 255 basis points, but it gained considerably in its other sources of income at 168 basis points. Harris Bank is known for providing substantial trust services and other associated services to customers in the Chicago region, and this is one way it has enhanced its profitability over the years. If one examines the profitability of this institution, what one sees is a relatively high level of investment income, expressed in terms of basis points, 488 basis points, because, in essence, the institution pays no interest to depositors or other borrowers. Almost all of the investment income is passed through to shareholders as return on equity. The interesting thing about this intermediary, though, is the relatively low cost of its total expenses. Here it's only 67 basis points per year. If one compares these expenses to the expenses of operating a depository institution that were several hundred basis points a year, one sees some of the competitive advantages that money market mutual funds currently enjoy in the financial services industry. As I've just mentioned a second ago, the total return on assets for this intermediary was 521 basis points. One looks at return on shareholders' equity, since almost all the assets in this intermediary are funded with shareholders' equity, the payment to the shareholders is roughly 5.2% per year. This on assets that yield, on average, 6.1% a year. So, looking at the overall balance sheet, what one sees is almost all of the investment return on the money market mutual fund is passed through to the shareholder, with a relatively small amount being expended on fund expenses and other items. Comparing this to Institution A is, of course, quite relevant. If you recall, Institution A earned more on its assets, 6.3% to 7.3%, depending on the type of assets, but was only able to pay its depositors 4.1%, a full 1% less than the rate of interest paid on the money market mutual funds. This is one of the reasons that Institution A would be hard-pressed to lower its payment on deposits, lest it lose more depositors to money market mutual funds. Over the past 10 or 15 years, the banking industry in the United States has faced serious competition from money market mutual funds, and in the last 10 years has sought to meet that competition by providing money market mutual funds of its own. One of the issues that we will study later in the lecture series is the legal barriers that impeded this expansion and how depository institutions eventually worked their way around these legal restrictions. The remaining three institutions in this exercise I'd like to talk through now rather quickly. Institution E is a different sort of institution than what we've already been looking at in today's lecture. The dominant characteristic of the liability side of the balance sheet of this intermediary is the presence of policy reserves and related liabilities. These are essentially insurance policy obligations to pay customers funds upon certain contingent events. So they're the corollary for deposits for insurance companies. And as we'll see when we get to that section of the lecture series, these liabilities present a number of special problems for the insurance industry. On the asset side of the balance sheet, the institution looks fairly similar to other intermediaries we've already discussed. The assets are predominantly financial, bonds and stocks being the largest segment of this balance sheet, but also some loans in real estate, mortgages, etc., as well as a relatively small amount of cash reserves. I would also note at this point that this balance sheet has an item called a separate account that appears on both asset and liability sides This is a special insurance product in the United States where the policies supported by these separate accounts participate in the performance of the separate account assets. So there is a direct linking between the separate accounts, which we will discuss towards the end of the lecture series. In terms of size, at $260 billion, this is a relatively large institution, and actually it's one of the larger American insurance companies. It's a Prudential Insurance Company, which is a well-known firm in the United States, specializing in life insurance as opposed to other forms of insurance. We will discuss insurance companies and return to this balance sheet later in the lecture series. Institution F is also a somewhat different sort of intermediary. On the asset side of the balance sheet, we see financial assets of various sorts, not so much loans, but various kinds of marketable securities and capital market instruments. That is not too dissimilar from some of the other intermediaries we've already seen, but the liabilities are really quite different. Short-term borrowings constitute 15% of the liabilities here. Another substantial percentage of liabilities come from something called repurchase agreements, which is another form, in essence, of short-term borrowing, as are the trading liabilities. So, like the finance company, all of the liabilities here come from borrowing transactions. They're not investments by the public. They're not deposits. They're not insurance policies issued to the public. They're really various forms of capital market borrowing and short-term borrowing. This is Merrill Lynch, one of the largest American securities firms, and it is not, strictly speaking, an intermediary. It does not borrow from the public and relend to the public. It is an entity invested in capital market instruments that are supported more or less by matching short-term borrowing. It has a relatively small equity cushion as a percentage of the assets, and in that sense it is similar to some of the other intermediaries we've looked at, but it really is in a different kind of business than the depository institutions we've looked at or the money market mutual fund. We will discuss in some detail securities firms towards the middle of the lecture series, and at that point we will return again to this balance sheet. The final balance sheet in the exercise is another kind of investment company. We've already seen a money market mutual fund. This is an ordinary mutual fund, and the principal difference is its assets are not limited to high quality corporate debt and government investments, but includes a substantial amount of equity securities. Principally, these would be common stocks traded in the stock market. This is, in fact, the Investment Company of America, with close to $40 billion of assets at the end of 1997. This was one of the oldest investment companies in the United States, although by no means the largest. This is the investment vehicle in the United States that is the principal means through which individual investors participate directly in our capital markets. Most equity holdings now in the United States are through these pooled investment vehicles, mutual funds. And if you look at the income statement for Institution G for 1997, you can get some sense why. The balance sheet, the income statement is a little bit difficult to decipher. You'll see there's some income coming from investment income, such as dividends and interest, but the primary investment returns here come from gains on investment, some realized, that is, the assets have been sold and the appreciation has been realized, and some unrealized gain, accounting for some $9 billion in 1997. This generated very substantial returns for the Investment Company of America. Its total expenses were relatively modest as a percentage of total returns. And so the return to shareholders in income appreciation and unrealized appreciation was over $9 billion, which equals a 23% rate of return for investors in this area. This compares to rates of return on bank deposits of 4%, of money market mutual funds of 5%, so a substantially higher rate of return. Of course, associated with that higher rate of return, a substantially greater degree of risk, which is something we will discuss throughout the lecture series. But at least in 1997, the rates of return on equity investments in the United States were very favorable. This concludes our discussion of the unidentified financial institution exercise. We will, however, return to these balance sheets from time to time throughout the lecture series. And in the next lecture, we will discuss the special regulatory problems that arise with these types of business enterprises. In particular, we will consider the special problems that come from raising money with financial liabilities of the sort that banks, insurance companies, securities firms, and investment companies issue to the general public, as well as problems that arise in connection with their reinvestment of those funds in financial assets. At this point, however, I would like to conclude this week's discussion with a few comments about the assignment for this week and also several questions that I would like the class to address through postings on this week's discussion group. In terms of the assignment, the important lesson I hope you'll take away from this week's lecture is to understand the basic structure of financial intermediaries as presented in the Unidentified Financial Institutions exercise. For those of you who are not familiar with financial statements and balance sheets, it may be necessary to look over once again the exercise in light of the comments I've made in this lecture. You should also take a look at the other sections of Chapter 1 of the casebook, in particular pages 8 through 10, where we discuss trends in the growth of financial intermediaries in the United States. This table, which appears in that section, will help you understand a little bit better the relative share of the financial services market each kind of financial intermediary holds in the United States. The tables also show you how those relationships have changed over time. As to the discussion group, what I would like each member of the class to do this week is to think about what we've discussed today and compare these financial institutions to those that exist in China today. In essence, I'm asking you to teach me a little bit about China to help me design the rest of the lectures. I would be particularly interested to know how the structure of financial intermediaries in China compares to the characteristic intermediaries from the United States I've been discussing in this lecture. I would also be interested to know how the relative size of the financial services industry compares in China to the industry in the United States. I don't expect members of the class to do specific research on these topics, but since most of you are studying financial regulation in China, these are issues upon which you may already have some opinions based on your prior study or experience outside of class. At any rate, what I'd like you to do is to react to the information I have been presenting to you in light of your knowledge of comparable institutions in China. The entries, incidentally, do not need to be lengthy. One or two paragraphs will be fine. And if you have a reaction to your colleagues' postings, please feel free to respond to those postings as opposed to introducing an original comment of your own, if you prefer to take that path. Finally, let me just say a few words about the next lecture. For those of you who wish to prepare in advance, the assignment will be from Chapter 3 of the casebook, and I will be focusing on Sections 1 and 2, which run from pages 117 to 141. In particular, I will be discussing the opinion of the Texas Attorney General which is starts on page 122, and the Arnold Torres case, which starts on page 131. I think it would be helpful if most members of the class had read these cases at least before listening to my lecture. I may also be posting next week something called A Problem on Asset Allocations, which will be available on the RFI webpage at approximately the same time that I post Lecture 2. I'd like to thank you all for your attention this week. I hope, again, the lecture has been of some interest to you. And please feel free to email me or post comments on the webpage if you have suggestions about how the lecture format might be improved in the future. I'm enjoying working with this new medium and experimenting with the technology each week. And I hope as time goes on, the lectures will get better and more useful to you. So thank you very much, and I will see you next week.